Okay, the proposed title on the bulletin board was Discipline or Disciple. And I wonder if you can clear your mind momentarily. And when I say a word, grab hold of the first thing that comes to your mind, no matter what it is. And I think you've done that before, you know. It's like those inkblot things where you can tell what you think of me. The very first thing that comes to your mind, grab onto that, and we'll go around and say what, you know, what came to our minds as we heard it. Are you ready? Okay, the word is discipline. Okay, what did you think?
Spanking.
Okay.
Correction. Punishment. Spanking. Or
punishment.
Punishment.
Disciple.
Okay, now, isn't this interesting? Now, maybe that was in your mind because, you know, we had just said that. But how many are there? 2, 4, 6, or 8 of you. And out of 8 people, only one person had anything that wasn't negative. And this is what we tend to think of with discipline. We have been brought up to feel like discipline is something that is harsh. She said hard. One of you said correction. Some of you said spanking, punishment. And punishment is certainly not a mild, usually a positive thing, but something that is hard and difficult to hold or to put up with. Webster says, and I jotted down a few things of the Webster meetings here, says discipline is training or experience that corrects, molds, strengthens, or perfects. Now, that isn't the same as what came to mind, was it? Okay. The second meaning in Webster, however, is punishment as a chastisement, self-inflicted as mortification, or imposed as a penance or as a penalty. And the next meaning is control gained by enforcing obedience of order, as in a school or an army. And the next meaning is a rule or system of rules affecting conduct or action. So if we want to talk about discipline, we could use any of those meanings, and they're not the same, are they? Mm-hmm. So there are lots of ways of thinking about discipline. And how we think about discipline as we raise the next generation determines a lot what kind of mental health they're going to have as adults, what kind of self-esteem they will develop. And were any of you at the forum the other night when we talked about what it was to be a grown-up, or has everybody there gone home? Okay, some of you were still there. I suspect that all of those things that people mentioned, that since some of you aren't there, let me read off a few of those things. One of them was to be let go. One of them was being grown-up comes from within yourself. One was that you don't have all the answers. Somebody said, I will be free. Someone said, you have more responsibility, or you have responsibility. Another one is making decisions. Somebody said they felt as an adult they were responsible for their own behavior. And somebody said they were able to receive. And another one was an ability to postpone gratification. Now, all of those were characteristics of being grown up that people threw out at the forum the other night. So, you know, how we are disciplined helps to determine whether we develop these positive adult traits or not. And we talked the other day, some of you were here, about you know, how to raise children so that they did become adults, because I think all of us know people who are chronologically adults who behave in very, very childlike ways, and they're not very much fun to live with. People who are irresponsible, that don't carry through, people who can't take another person's point of view, all kinds of things, that people that can't make decisions, that are disorderly, and it makes it hard for the rest of us to live with people when they really do not grow up. So we need to think about that. I would like to, you know, throw some stuff out at you for a while, and I hope to get it done quickly enough that we can, you know, get to your major concerns and talk about stuff. Discipline is such a huge subject, to even try to begin to treat it in an hour is sort of, you know, silly, because I wish we could meet together like over a year's period, an hour every week, and then maybe as you went home and tried to try these things out on your children and see if you liked them or not, or if they worked and why they didn't work, we might be able to, you know, you might be able to build some attitudes. I think the reason that I feel the way I do about them is because as I've learned these things, I've had a classroom of children, you know, besides the four at home, that I could practice these things or try them out and see if they worked and change and modify my own behavior, and I have learned a great deal about discipline, and I think the main thing that I've learned is to avoid it. And I think that may sound to you like, well, you know, I'm going to get up and walk out if she's not going to tell me how to discipline. But I think when one really lives what I like to call the life in baptism, and I think I kind of picked that up from Walt a few years back, when we live in a relationship with children that involves love and forgiveness, and the kind of love and forgiveness that we're taught in the gospel, that discipline becomes a totally different thing. It does not become the punishment that came to all of our minds when I threw out that word. And that is not at all unusual. I mean, that is the normal thing for us to all think of spanking and harsh punishments, but rather to think of it as control gained, as training or experience that corrects, molds, strengthens, or perfects. And when we were trying to think of a title for this session, it was Walt who said discipline or disciple, because he's, you know, with his theological training, is into linguistics, I guess, in Hebrew and Greek. And the word disciple and the word discipline come from the same root. So if you look at it that way, it may give you, and you know, try to keep that in mind as you work with your children, it does give you a different direction to head, that as someone who is doing the disciplining, if you can create a disciple rather than being the one that enforces. When you think of a disciple, you know, why did the disciples follow Jesus? Was it because he was going to really let them have it if they didn't? You know, are we punished if we don't? What made them do it?
They wanted to.
Huh? Yeah.
Love, respect, admiration.
Yes. They wanted to, didn't they? It was something within them that said, hey, here's something I want. Mm-hmm. So that's the clue with the children, too. To the children, we are models, and we set a way, a lifestyle with the children. And if you can set up a lifestyle with your children that is based on trust and mutual respect. I mean, we all expect children to respect adults, don't we? I know when we were talking about this growing up, one of the hardest things for me as a grown-up was that I went overnight from being a child to an adult as far as my own feelings and society were concerned, because I was a college girl and I graduated one day, came home the next day, got married the next day, and became the preacher's wife. You know, within a month's time, I went from being a child to an adult as far as my status in society was. And it was the hardest thing in the world for me to call these loving ladies in our congregation by their first names. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it, because I had been trained that, you know, a young person respects an adult by calling them Mrs. So-and-so or Aunt So-and-so. And for me to just call them Jane or Hilda or whatever their names were was so hard. Because I was only 21, and I still, you know, the change was too abrupt, and I hadn't become used to that. So it was a matter of, you know, what was respect. So, you know, you have to decide as you discipline a child, is this showing respect for this child's integrity when I do this sort of thing? And when you consider some of the harsher methods of discipline that people have imposed, do they really show respect for the person, for the child as a person, as a human being? You know, would you do the same thing to your best friend? Let's say your best friend has let you down. You expected her to, here's an example. I have a good friend that I recently asked for a list of books. She had gone to a great deal of, a list of publishers. She had gone to a great deal of trouble to go to the offices of our professional organization, and I don't know what they have there, but she called out a list of publishers because she's writing a book and she wants to, you know, see who will buy it and send this manuscript. And I said to her, well, since you've gone all that work, you know, would you save me the time and let me borrow that list? Oh, she said, sure, I'll be glad to. I've asked her three times, and three times she said, look, I'll give it to my husband, and he'll get a Xerox at the office, and I'll send it to you. And she hasn't done that. You know, she's let me down, and I'm embarrassed to ask her again. But now, if that were my child that had done that, you know, how would I deal with that? I might yell at him. I might spank him. You know, can you imagine me hitting this woman because she hadn't done this? I might say to him, well, because you haven't done this for me, I will therefore not do such and such for you. And I might, you know, do that to my friend. Say to her, well, you know, you, well, in fact, she asked me if I would write a letter she was fired from a job she had, and it was very unjust. It was a political thing. And so she asked me if I would write a letter to the person who was above the person who had done this, which I did. You know, and I could have said to her, heck no, I'm not going to write that for you because you didn't, when I asked you for that list of books, you didn't do it for me. So, you know, this is your punishment, which is, you know, what a lot of people do to children. Now, would that have shown any respect for her? So, you know, if we want children to learn how to respect, we have to teach them. The only way they can learn that is by being respected. They can't learn it by us demanding respect. We can command respect, but we can't demand respect. Do you know what I mean? The difference there. And the only way you can do it is by respecting the child, the integrity of the child. Okay, so actually the goal of discipline that you want to get at with a child, it's really crucial not to just think of this particular act that needs something done about it, but to think of the long-range program. You know, what do you want eventually of this child? You know, as you think about your children growing into adulthood, what do you want of them? Do you want a child who needs somebody to stand there and impose rules upon him? Or do you want an adult who is able to, you know, think things through and make the best decision and carry on with it? You know, which is really being grown up? And there are many, many, many grown-ups in the world who only do what they're told if there is a reward or punishment in it, right? Can you think about that? I had a plumber come to my house one day, and his child happened to go to the same junior high school that mine did, which had modular scheduling. And somehow or other we got on that subject. I wish I'd never gotten into that somehow, because I discovered that he was very angry at this modular scheduling. He had gone up to the school and discovered his child in a room with no adult. And I said, well, you know, what was she doing there? Well, she was supposed to be studying, doing her assignments, you know. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? Well, he says, you know, she's not going to do it if there isn't some teacher standing over there making her do it. And I said, oh, don't you think, you know, that she needs to learn to carry out her responsibilities on her own without the teacher having to, okay, you know, turn to page 16, now you do the next six problems there. And he said, no, he says, nobody can do that. He said, down at the plant where I work, he was doing the plumbing for me on a moonlighting basis. He said, down at the plant where I work, he said, you know, nobody would do their work if the foreman didn't stand there and watch them. And I said, well, you know, who watches the foreman? Who watches the one who watches the foreman? I mean, eventually we do have to have a few people who can manipulate on their own without somebody standing over them with a whip. You know, now do you want your child to be, you know, just the follower who only does what they're told, or do you want to develop children who can, you know, function on their own at the best possible level? I knew a youngster one time whose roommate was shipped home midway through the freshman year of college, and the reason was that the parents found out over Christmas vacation that this kid was spending all his allowance on pot. This was in the 60s, and it was, you know, the age of rebellion. And the problem was that he was smoking pot and spending all his allowance on that. And so the parents said, you will come home and you will go to the local college and we will buy you a Volkswagen. Okay, so here's the reward, the bribe. It will buy you a car and if you will come home. Although actually I don't think they gave him a choice. So they switched him. They enrolled him into Augsburg College instead of St. Olaf. He lived at home. And he had his car, which was a nice bribe. Now, whether he continued buying pot at Augsburg College, as he had done at St. Olaf, I couldn't tell you because I lost track of him at that point. But the roommate who told me about this, I said, why do you think he did that? And he said, well, Kevin always does what he's told. He has never learned to make his own decisions or to stand on his own two feet. And so, you know, when some kid said, you know, here, try this, it's nice, you know, come on, buy some more, he did it. Because he wasn't able to think it through and say, now, you know, is this really where my priorities are? Do I really want to spend my money on this, or would I rather have records? Or, you know, would I rather spend it on hamburgers and malts? Or, you know, he just did what he was told. And you see the pattern that he did with the parents told him. He came home and went to Augsburg. And at this point, this is a very, very bright boy. The last I heard of him, he is working for an ice cream company loading trucks. You know, and this is a boy with a four-year college degree who has an IQ of, I know that it is over 40 because I first met him in an elementary school program, that you had to have an IQ of 140 in order to be considered for in the first place. So, you know, it's really kind of wasted. And probably half of the problem is that the kid has never, ever learned to do his own thinking. He's always just done what he was told. And when you're loading an ice cream truck, you can do what you're told. Whereas, you know, other jobs that he would have to take at this point in his life might require his organizing things and doing them himself. We have a weird history of discipline in our country. There was a day when everybody disciplined in an authoritarian manner. The authorities knew best and they imposed this. This was also a day when things were very homogeneous in our country. There was a basic set of values which are still being touted as basic American virtues. Then we went through a stage when people sort of rebelled against this, and probably because it wasn't working too well anymore, and they began to worry about damaging the poor little child's psyche and that sort of thing. And so there was declared a hands-off policy. We went from, you know, total authoritarian to the opposite extreme of a laissez-faire upbringing. And I think that was true around in the early 20s somewhere, where parents just sort of let kids make their own decisions. I've run into parents like that. You know, why don't you think you should be bringing this child to church? No, I'm not going to tell him anything at all. When he's an adult, he can make up his own mind. Well, this is really kind of foolish, because children are learning all the time, whether you are setting out to teach them or not. They are learning. They can't just turn off learning because nobody is specifically teaching them something. They will learn by default. And what happened to those children that grew up in that era were that they had even worse mental health than the children who were brought up under harsh authoritarianism, because they had nothing to base anything on, and they felt unwanted eventually. Nobody cares enough to set any limits for me. Nobody cares enough to say no to me when I'm damaging something or when I'm hurting myself. And they developed very low self-esteem, because they really didn't feel, they felt insecure, because the person who should have been caring for them seemed to be not caring for them by having a hands-off policy. So I think at this point in time, I see a lot of people, and especially people in the church, trying to return to an authoritarian discipline where you hear a lot of these things like the basic youth encounters. Swarms of people run to that. And probably the basis for that is that today's values are changing so quickly. We are in a terrible state of flux right now, and we have such diverse values in our culture that you may have one set of values in your home, and the people on either side of you have two totally different sets of values from either yours or each other's. The school teachers are giving still different sets of values. The police department may not even be able to agree on what values they have. So we're faced with this not only changing values, but a great diversity of values, which makes it very, very difficult to raise children in this era, and makes it even more crucial that children learn decision-making just as early as possible, since the authoritarian is not always with the children. And if in an earlier day, maybe like when my parents were raised, you could count on the fact that when the child went out the door, that the school teacher, the shopkeeper, you know, all the adults that child met were also having the same values of honesty and virtue and so on that you were trying to teach at home. That would be reinforced. You can't count on that anymore, can you? You know, even when you turn on the television set, you are finding all sorts of values that you may disagree with terribly are being piped right into your home. You know, they don't even have to go out the door anymore. The values get piped in. So it becomes even more crucial to find a way that we can help children to establish this goal of inner controls and of self-discipline. And the younger the better, because my word, by the time they're five, you know, they leave us and we don't know what they're being taught by some other person out in the world. Even when we sent them to Sunday school, we don't know. We discovered in our first church we had a teacher that was teaching the children that there is no life after death. You know, how could she even call herself a Christian if she didn't believe in a life after death? That's, you know, one of the central parts of our religion. So, you know, the minute the child leaves your side, you don't know what other values they're getting. So, you know, how can we do this now? We can't use the hands-off thing, and we can't anymore ram it down their throats like our great-grandparents did and be successful. So, you know, we're really in a, I think, a very, very difficult, I don't really envy you with all your little babies there to teach, because it gets more difficult, I think, every year to bring children up. I think there are a couple reasons why we need to work on some kind of a middle ground, and I think one of the reasons parents are returning to authoritarianism is they don't see any other alternative from the laissez-faire way that a lot of people raise their children. Just, you know, we'll let them, you know, I don't care, it's too difficult. And I think a lot of people are actually copping out nowadays because it is so hard and they don't know what to do. And that's probably why parenting classes are abounding. But the trouble is there's so many books being written and there's so many classes and they're all telling you different things. But let me caution you, do be wary about the people that are saying, you know, back to the basics and, you know, let's let father rule the roost kind of thing. And I'm going to give you some reasons here why I think that's really a dangerous trend for people. For one thing, one of the reasons is that we are living in a democracy. And the ironic thing to me is that the very people who are asking us to go back to authoritarianism and have father lay down the law and then mother impose the law father has laid down on the children, those are the very people that are yelling pinko all the time. And this is really weird, because if you really believe in democracy, then you've got to teach it in your home. And if you believe in democracy, then you believe in shared power. There are only three ways power can go. One is that the adults keep the power, and that's the authoritarian way. The second way, that's, you know, one extreme. The other extreme is that the adults give the power away and let the kids do whatever they want to do. So, you know, and neither of those develop children that have strong values or good self-esteem. And when you don't have good self-esteem, you are very likely to let other people make your decisions for you and push you around, manipulate you, which is like, you know, Kevin, that the other kids in the dorm who had pot to sell could manipulate him into buying it. Okay, but there is a middle ground, and that is shared power. And that is exactly what democracy is all about, isn't it? You know, we decide who is going to run the thing for us, and we have input on the rules by virtue of choosing people to make the rules and by being able to write letters to them. I heard on the radio the other day that 18 letters is enough to make a congressman change his vote. So, you know, we do have a system, whether we're using it or whether it's working, is not the question here. The thing is that we, as Americans, say that we believe in a system where everybody has input and where we don't have a family who are above the rest of us, like some of the other countries in the world do, and we don't have a dictatorship where one person has the power and everybody has to kowtow to that, and if you don't, you know, into the concentration camp for you, because this guy has the power and you don't dare disagree. So this is, I think, one crucial reason for us believing that we should share the power in the home and ask children to help with the decision making. For one thing, it's one of the things that came up at the adult thing the other night was how difficult it is when you are raised in an authoritarian atmosphere to suddenly be 18 or 20, you know, you graduate from college and all of a sudden you're on your own and you're supposed to be able to make decisions, but you've never had any practice. How do you learn to make decisions? You can only learn to make them by making them. And we hit on that the other day a little bit about saying, you know, you are the adult that has the experience and knows what's important or knows what's safe. And when it comes to health and safety and the rights of other people, you know, then you may have to step in and say something or give some guidance. But within that, you can give all sorts of practice. I think it was you two that I was giving my favorite example of. A two-year-old can make some decisions. Now that may sound like, you know, what does a two-year-old know? But you can give a two-year-old practice in decision-making. You can say, what would you like for lunch? But you don't just, you know, open it up to the world, because that's too much for a little child to handle. So you're the one with the experience, so you limit that in. Would you like, and you don't say, would you like a peanut butter sandwich or a chocolate bar, because one of those is not a valid choice. And the minute the kid says chocolate bar, you start arguing with him that he really should have chosen the peanut butter sandwich, you see, which again diminishes his self-esteem, because, well, you know. So, you know, don't give a choice unless there really is a choice. You know, don't say, well, you know, what should we do today? And then the kid says, well, let's go to the zoo. And you say, well, no, we can't go to the zoo because blah, 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 blah. You know, give a few choices that the child really can choose from. we can avoid an awful lot of discipline hassles if we allow choices within a range. Like clothing, for instance. If you only buy clothing that the child can wear to play in, you know, and stuff that goes together, then you don't need to worry about whether the kid is going to put on, you know, like if you buy all striped t-shirts and plain pants, instead of buying three pairs of plaid pants and three striped t-shirts, but you get plain shirts to go with the plaid pants and plain pants to go with the striped shirts. But the kid can't understand that, so he wants to wear the plaid pants and the striped shirt. And it's his mother, you think, well, what will the neighbors think when he's out there with those clashing outfits? And then you got to hassle about that. Well, you avoid that by buying all plain pants and striped t-shirts, or all plaid pants and plain things, so that no matter what the kid chooses, it works. And your needs for, you know, for not looking at this mess are met, and his needs for making choices are met. Now, see, I tend to ramble. That's why I have to look down here. Make sure we're keeping on the right here thing here. Okay, another reason for that I think that we need to hit on this middle ground is that we want our children to develop the highest moral level that we can. I wish we had could have one whole session on moral levels. There's a guy named Kohlberg. Have any of you read any of Kohlberg's research on moral levels?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just going to really condense it horribly, Pat, because it's you know, really quite complicated. But Kohlberg feels that people have certain levels of moral development. Your moral development can go up as you grow intellectually, so that people who are mentally retarded can't get above a certain level. But it doesn't necessarily go up with your intellectuals. And the first lecture I heard on it, the guy said, take Richard Nixon, for example, whose intellectual age, you know, IQ, is probably very, very high, but whose moral level is probably down at like level two. The lowest level, stages one and two, would be where the person works for reward or punishment. You know, you'll avoid the punishment or you'll work for a reward. You know, and dogs and cats work on that level. And I think that we tend to deal with children like that. We even sometimes do that with ourselves, don't we? You know, if I finish cleaning the house, I can sit down and have a cup of coffee, or I'll even allow myself a piece of fudge. If I wasn't overweight today, I can have a piece of candy or a piece of pie or something. But and we don't ever outgrow we use all as we attain the next level. We still use the ones below it. The next set of levels is where you work for your group. If it's good for Holden Village, then I'll do it. But you know, I don't care about the state of Washington kind of thing, because that isn't my group. I don't live here. And then the higher ones get to be where you look at for the good of the whole, whether it's damaging to you personally. I mean, somebody like Albert Schweitzer is at the very top level, you know, somebody who gave up everything to go out there because he felt this was going to really do something good for the whole. And even though, well, like here at Holden, we're told we're not eating a lot of red beef, even though we probably all would love to have a good steak for dinner tonight, because for the good of the whole world, it is better, the reasoning is, that grain not be fed to cattle, that it be used, you know, it takes up too much space to grow grain for cattle. It's a waste and so on. So we are making that personal sacrifice, which isn't good for us personally, but for the total picture of the whole world, it's better. So you see, you go from a very self-centered thing to a more socialized centered thing. You know, first it's just me, what's good for me, what I get out of it. And then it goes to a little bit broader spectrum, to what my group gets out of it, until finally it's to what everything gets out of it. So that it is a wider and wider thing. Okay, so if we are using an authoritarian approach, which involves, you know, punishment and reward systems, we are keeping our children at the lowest level, aren't we? We aren't helping them to outgrow their self-centered approach to life, that this is good for me, and if I do what Daddy says, then I'll avoid punishment. And a lot of things that we do actually teach children that, even though we don't set out to, because they do tend to avoid punishment. Punishment is uncomfortable. Walt tells a darling story. I hope he wouldn't mind if I borrow this and tell it to you, but he tells it when he's giving a lecture on baptism, but it fits so beautifully here that I've used it many, many times with parents. One time he came home and found that there was scribbling on the back of the bathroom door. And he strongly suspected that Greg had done it because Greg was 3 and the other two boys were, I don't know, 10 and 11 or 11 and 12, something like that. But, you know, they were well out of the scribble on the wall stage. But he didn't want to just come out and, you know, give Greg a whomp for that. So he said, who did this? And everybody said, no, they didn't do it, including Greg. So he thought, well, the way Walt tells it is so cute. I wish I could replay his tape at this point. He said, well, he thought he'd try Plan B then. Well, when did you do it? And still it was denied. And then he tried Plan C. I've forgotten what that was. What did you use to do it with or something like that? And finally, it struck Walt that that he was forcing Greg to lie. Because, you know, Greg knew from experience that the minute he admitted having done this, he was going to get spanked. So, you know, the kid was really in a double bind. And it was at this point that it hit Walt, you know, that he was keeping this child at the lowest level of moral development but because he was putting him in this double bind. The only way out for this child, because the child was at this low level of moral development, you see, was that he would have to avoid the punishment because that's uncomfortable. Nobody's going to take punishment if they don't see any reason to, are they? So, you know, then they sat down and had a family talk about it. Well, then he said to this little guy, mind you, 3 years old, but this is a very smart kid, Greg, if you knew that I wouldn't spank you, if I promised not to spank you, would you tell me that you scribbled on the back of the bathroom door? Yes. So quick. Yes. See? You know, he had done it, but he was avoiding the punishment, the easiest thing for him. So, you know, we need to be careful that we don't put children in that position where they're in a double bind. They're going to get it coming or going. Okay. That, you see, has to do with power. Who has the power? Now, I think as Christians that we also need to think about where our children are with their religious background, too. And I risk getting my theology off key here. My husband always points out to me that I should stay out of theology. In fact, Walt said to me, leave the theology to me, and then he laughed. Ha, 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 ha. But when I look at the Old Testament, you know, the Old Testament, God gave us a set of rules. We've got these Ten Commandments, and they all say, don't do this, and don't do this, and don't do this, and don't do this. But when Christ came, what did he do with those 10 rules? Remember?
Capitalized them and said, do this.
And how many did he come up with?
One with lots of parts.
Yeah. I think it is sort of like two parts, isn't it? You love God and you love your neighbor. And when you look at it, all those Ten Commandments are covered by those two rules. But man, does that leave you with a lot of decision making, doesn't it? You know, if I do this, is that loving my labor or not? Whereas don't steal, that's a little bit more, I mean, even that has a lot of, you know, is this stealing or not stealing? But it's still a little bit easier than just love your neighbor. You know, if you love your neighbor, you're not going to steal from him, are you? Although I did try to steal Matthew Cameron's licorice last night, saying that this is not good for his teeth. Therefore, I would be doing him a favor. Because, you know, mine are already all gold. I don't need to worry about it. He's still at an age where dental caries are a big worry. So, you know, I feel that very strongly that we need to hit that middle ground because it fits our Christian beliefs that love your neighbor, and who is your neighbor, you know, anybody that you hit up against. So that brings us to, you know, do we need rules or don't we need rules? Because Christ certainly did get those rules, you know, down to a rather broad, general sort of way of thinking about things. And I think most of us discover that we really do need to have rules, unless we're going to be somebody like Thoreau and, you know, go live all by our little selves out in Walden Pond. And the reason we need to develop some rules in a group is because each of us has rights. And each of us wants our own rights. And I think this is another place parents have gotten into trouble. Some mothers particularly, I think, have been so self-sacrificing that they begin to let the kids walk all over them. And then the kids don't ever learn to give. They learn to be selfish. And, you know, just about the time it's too late to train the kids the other way, mother begins to feel walked on. You know, all these years she has done all these things, and now the kids are old enough that they could really add a little bit to the workload. And what happens? You know, they're all off doing their own selfish little things, and mother begins to resent it and feel put upon. So that isn't very helpful either. Let's see, I guess I did. Okay, and I think we get an example from the scriptures too, because God did give us some rules to live by, and they are social rules. The one is to look up to God and to seek His will, and the other one is to, you know, to love your neighbor, which means that you're going to have to take another person's point of view, doesn't it? Now, let me warn you that the people cannot do that until they begin to be able to do that somewhere around 3 1/2, maybe. And it takes them, you know, many, many years to develop that ability. Some people never do develop it. You probably know adults who really, honestly cannot take another person's point of view. They simply can't understand how another person feels. And so they are insensitive. Like people in a motel that are out there yelling at 2 a.m. or up at, you know, at 6 in the morning and honking their horns and calling back and forth to each other. That's insensitive. And they're not thinking, gosh, you know, there are other people who also paid their $30 to sleep in this room tonight who are still trying to sleep. That is an immature person who is still working at, you know, about a 4-year-old level. So kids need help with that. They need help in learning, you know, how to take another person's point of view, but we mustn't ask it of them, you know, so young that they feel like they're not good. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about rules and how we develop rules, because they're, when you talk about disciplining children, you need to worry about, you know, whether they're breaking the rules or not. And I think kids get punished for breaking rules that maybe are unfair rules, and then the child develops a very low self-esteem again because he feels like he's not very worthwhile. So let's give some clues for developing rules, and then I'll give you a neat way of helping children with that, and then I hope we'll have time to talk a little bit too. Boy, that time is really going. Okay, the first one is take Christ's clue there and have as few rules as possible. I mean, the more rules you have, the more hassle you are going to have trying to enforce them. I was called into a daycare center as a troubleshooter a few years ago, and the tension was so thick in that room you could almost cut it with a knife. I mean, the children were like this. They were just so tense. And as the time went on, I began to realize that these children were tense because they were trying to remember the rules lest I come down on them with, you know, with my power and yell at them or punish them. And there were so many rules. It was incredible. There was no way children 3 and 4 years old could possibly remember these rules. The second day I was there, out of 14 little children, 7 children said to me, "May I eat my toast now?" And I thought, what on earth is going on here? Why are they asking me to eat their toast? It's breakfast time. They're hungry. They've been given a piece of toast. Why don't they just automatically eat it? 2 weeks later, a little boy told me, the rule is you can't eat your toast until you've eaten half your cereal. You know, now why would there even be a rule like that? Toast and cereal are in the same food group. Why would the teacher care one bit which they ate or if they ate one or the other? In fact, some of them, the appetites were so small there was no way they could eat both the toast and the cereal. So why shouldn't they make a choice? It was actually the same food in a different form. Okay, I think I figured out why all these rules. The teacher had a low self-esteem and she needed power to make herself feel like a nifty person. And she had all these little kids she could manipulate with these rules. And if they broke them, then that gave her a feeling of strength and power because she could then punish them for it. She had a rule that you could play with those toys before 10:30, and the toys on the other side of this piece of taped-on construction paper you could play with after 10:30. Well, you think they could remember if it was before 10:30 or after 10:30 or even tell? I mean, it was just crazy, and I overheard two little girls playing school, and the one yelled loud and clear, "Well, the rule is..." So, you know, it came out over the first few weeks that I worked in that group that there were rules upon rules upon rules upon rules, and the children were absolutely discouraged at even trying to keep these rules. So if we establish so many rules that can be broken and be punished, that you could be punished if you break them, you are setting yourself up for a hassle that, you know, that's going to be just a nightmare to administer. And it gets so relaxed when you can condense all your rules, like Christ did, into these basic rules that, you know, if it's for health or safety or somebody else's rights, that's how you figure out what the rules are. So that you don't have all these specific rules. Well, you can't go into your brother's room unless he tells you you can, or something like that. You know, silly stuff like that. It's so unrelaxed. And what it trains kids to do is to be devious, because they can't remember all that. They can't abide with all that. So have a few as possible. Okay, another basic for making up rules is to be sure that everybody's needs are covered. Because if you are making up rules that only take into account mother's needs, you know, like there is going to be no rock and roll played in this house because I don't like rock and roll, you know, and I don't, and I listen to an awful lot of rock and roll, then that only takes into account my tastes and my desires. And then that isn't fair to the four young people that, you know, in the past have lived in my house who really want to listen to rock and roll. So, you know, is that fair? Isn't this their home? So that's going to make it very, very hard for me to enforce that. And it certainly is not going to do anything to build their relationship to me, is it, if I impose my needs and likes and dislikes on them without saying, you know, I'm willing to listen to that part of the time, but I would also like to hear some symphony music because that's what I like. And I have one kid who's very nice about changing the radio to the symphony station when he leaves the house, because now it's mother's turn. Okay, and another thing then is don't break the rule yourself. I mean, you can't have rules for little people that don't, you know, that you don't have to abide by. I can't think of one right offhand.
If your child can't snack before dinner, neither can your husband.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a man in here last year who said something like that, you know, that we were talking about this whole mealtime hassle of not eating or what eating, and all of a sudden it came out. He wasn't going to eat casseroles. Okay, see, what that says then is that father is better than kids because he can snack, but we can't. And here we get our clue, I think, from scriptures again. You know, all those stories, you remember the mother that came to Christ and said, you know, well, who's going to get to sit at your right hand up in heaven? You know, my boy's going to be there, kind of thing. You know, there shouldn't be status. We all need to be important. The reason that you and I have it over the kids is not because we're better than them or have more status. It's because we have more experience. We've lived longer. That's the thing that gives us an edge over them. But our biggest wedge over children is their tremendous need for belonging. You know, they will do anything to feel like they belong to us. They have got to have that. That is a gut-level need. That's a crucial need, like the need for food. So, you know, they've got to have that. And that's the way that you can get them to do things, because you belong with them. Okay, now that is, you see, or I mean, they need to belong. That's a higher level of moral development than the reward-punishment system. You know, because we belong to this group, we do thus and so. So, okay, when you start working on that with your, you know, children that are a little older, then you're bringing them up from the reward-punishment moral level to the next higher level. This is our group. I remember a little boy came into a friend of mine, and he wanted to do this, and so because all the kids were doing it, and his mother said something, and he says, well, but everybody's doing it. And she said, yes, but remember, you're, and he says, I know, I'm not everybody, I'm a Haugen. So, you know, he was about 6 years old, I think, and for at that stage of life, that level worked for him. He wasn't everybody. He was special because he belonged to this group, and this group cared about him.
But another way. Don't spank your child for hitting another.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's that, because then you're doing what you're telling him not to do. Yeah.
I'm sure I've done it, but I see it in one of my neighbors, and it just doesn't seem right.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should, let's come back to that, yeah, that spanking bit a minute, too, because I'd like to, you know, say a few things on how, you know, if there is something that you do feel you need to discipline, what kinds of ways are helpful to a child to choose. Because that one, on the long run, proves that it isn't. It does stop the behavior, but in the long run, it doesn't have very good effects. Okay, so you want to be sure that it covers everybody's needs. And, okay, then. All right, the things then to consider when you do make up your few rules is health and safety and other people's needs. Those are the three things the rule should be based on. And outside of that, you really can be pretty loosey-goosey with it and let the kids make a lot of decisions. But that means that you're going to have to take into consideration, and this is the next point, that you don't cut across the developmental level of the child. If you are asking a child to have, well, here's an example. When my kids were very, very small, I had one child who picked everything up to examine it and clunked it down, and there was a dent in the table or a chip in the you know, china bone dish that was an antique or something. So now, I have seen people, in fact, 2 years ago, we came up here from New Orleans when the gathering was there, you know. We sat in the hotel restaurant, and there was the most adorable 2-year-old at the next table. They put him up to the table, and the first thing he did, which was the most normal thing in the world for a 2-year-old, was to reach for the silverware. 2-year-olds are curious. You know, they've only been here 2 years, and they want to know about everything. So he reached for the silverware. His father took it away and slapped his hand. And he went like this. See, father had power. So then the next thing he did was to reach for the glass of water. So, you know, the next thing the father took that and he slapped the hand again. Pretty soon, I overheard the father say something about belt. Pretty soon the father left the room and came back, I kid you not, with a belt, a big man's belt this wide, rolled up, and he sat the rest of the time. Apparently the father had dinner and just retrieved this mother and child from the airport or the train something, or I don't know, because the mother and child ate and the father didn't. But he sat there with this belt in his hand, holding it in front of this 2-year-old child as a threat lest he touch anything else. Now that is grossly unfair. He was expecting behavior of a 2-year-old that was inappropriate for a 2-year-old. You know, now if that 2-year-old could not sit at that table without touching anything and that bothered the parent, then whose needs were that? Was that? It was the father's needs that these things be left untouched. So, you know, what the father should have had a different alternative, like say to the mother, you sit here in order, and when the food comes, I'll bring Johnny in to eat. Meanwhile, I'll pace him back and forth in the lobby where he can look and touch. So, you know, a little child's environment has got to fit his needs, and we mustn't be asking him to do things that aren't good for him. And I think another thing we need to do is to get off our own little old high horse. I think the biggest thing that upper middle class mommies need to be told is it is all right to have a mess in your house, ladies. You know, relax. Because children need to make things and they need to make messes. When you make dinner, what happens to the kitchen? You know, could you possibly make dinner and have that kitchen all tidied up all the time? That's what the kitchen is for, and it is legitimate to mess up the kitchen and make dinner. And then what do you do? Who cleans it up? Okay, does that give you some clue with the kid? There has got to be a place in every child's life where it is legitimate for him to do kid stuff which makes messes. Where the, you know, if he's got a carpeted bedroom and he's into model airplanes with this gooey stuff, what's that going to say to him? I can't use model dope in my bedroom because it will ruin the carpeting. There is a grave danger that somebody 12 years old is going to knock that over and spill it. I mean, somebody my age might knock that over and spill it. So, you know, maybe he isn't ready for carpeting in the bedroom. Maybe the best thing is to go get a hunk of linoleum or, you know, put in something that doesn't matter. Or else there's got to be a room in the basement or the garage or someplace where it is comfortable and legitimate. I have just taken my mother to visit a young friend of mine who has a 4-year-old. This girl is in despair. This child is running her up the walls because she opens her sewing box and what does she find? 2 hair curlers and a cassette tape. Here's the cassette my husband has been hunting for last week that he needed for a meeting. What's it doing in here? The 10-year-old comes up the stairs. Mom, Johnny's got the TV knob again. Ask him where he put it. Where is it, Johnny? Johnny runs off, it's under his bed. He knows exactly where it is. Well, why is this child ruining everything? You know, why is he putting his mother's curlers in her sewing set, but she can't find her pincushion? You know, why is the father's cassette tape in there and he can't find his car keys? It's because this child has no child environment. So he is doing just what is the normal four-year-old thing. He's playing with all this stuff because he hasn't got the kind of toys that he needs. He doesn't have a space of his own. His bedroom has a bed in it and it has a chest of drawers. It's a sterile environment for a four-year-old kid. Let me tell you, preschoolers will not tolerate boredom. And that, as a teacher of preschoolers, I can tell you.
We know that.
This is where your big problem comes in, motivate. I mean, you've got to be a good teacher or you lose them. I mean, they will physically get up and leave. Whereas, you know, I can sit here and bore you people to death, and because you came in here, you feel like, gee, I wish I'd gone to Elmer Wood's session because that would have been more interesting. But you will politely sit here and, you know, and tolerate this. Because you're mature, but little kids will not do that. And this four-year-old is not doing it. He cannot live in that house all day long, every day of his, you know, of his whole third year and his whole fourth year and his fifth year's coming up, and not have anything to do. He's got to learn. He's got to manipulate things. That's how he learns about his world. But if we don't provide, you know, an environment that is rich in things that he can manipulate and change and put together and undo, you know, lots of junk to play with, and he needs little people toys, and he needs blocks, and I mean, he needs things that will change. And when he gets bigger, he needs things like Tinker toys and Erector sets, and he needs old cardboard boxes that you can throw out when you're done. And he needs to be given masking tape instead of toys that run with batteries. You know, things that he can manipulate and change and experiment with. He needs lots of time with the water play. Lots of mothers are not going to let their kids play with water. He might get wet. He might get cold. It might make a mess. Find some way to keep him warm and dry when he plays with water, because he needs to do that. That's a marvelous therapy. I've been working in a preschool room where they have a water table, and it sits there with a lid on it, and it's always got stuff stored on top of it. Now, you know, the people who put, those of us who set that center up, put that water table in there because this is the most marvelous way for little kids to begin to learn math and physics. And, boy, I'll tell you, bath time. You want to know a nifty thing with bath time if you've got little kids? Put them in the stationary tubs in the basement with water up to here. Give them all kinds of pouring stuff, little people, little animals, and keep them in there half an hour. You can do your ironing, your laundry folding. You know, you can't kick your eyes off of them. But man, they come out of there, they're clean, even under their fingernails is clean. You don't have to scrub. You can put them on the wash machine to dry them and you don't break your back. And they're so relaxed and they go right to sleep without a peep, because that's such a fulfilling experience. But you know, to say, yeah, but I don't want to do that because, well, I don't have laundry tubs, that has to go in the bathroom. I remember my mother coming to visit me one time saying, you know, I think this is terrible. This bathroom has to be scrubbed down every single day. But those children were learning. That was a vital part of their learning, even though the bathroom floor got wet. You know, and I mean, it was an easy thing to clean up. It was tile. I kept wishing that the builder had put a drain in the middle of the floor. But the thing is, you know, you change the environment to fit the child's developmental level. You don't make rules that cut across that developmental level, because what that says to the child is, what I am, you know, the way God made me is not good. My mother doesn't like the way I am. I gotta wiggle. I have a thing about this with church, because church says to little kids, be quiet and don't move. And yet everything within them is saying, move. Have you ever watched a newborn baby? All during its waking moments, what's it doing? Its arms are going like this, aren't they? And its legs the whole time. Doesn't your little one move all the time when it's awake? You know, it's... This is a physical need of the child, and yet we take them to church and say, this is God's house, he loves you very much, but don't you do what he made you to do while you're in here. You know, I mean, it's contradictory, yeah.
Okay, a little aside on that. What do you suggest then? Because I'm just getting ready, I'm just beginning to think about taking my three-year-old to church. Do you think that's too early, or what could it be bigger than do I expect?
Well, I don't know. I had one three-year-old that could go to church and sit, you know. And he's still my quiet one. And I had three others that when I took them to church, nobody worshipped around me. I didn't worship. They were just wigglers. When Mark was four, Herb gave him pages of math problems to do during the sermon. You know, and he had to save them till the sermon, because that was the most boring part for him. I mean, he didn't understand the sermon at age four. What was there to listen to? And by then he was done looking at the stained glass windows, and there was no music to listen to, which he liked. I don't really know the answer to that. I belong to a church where the kids just, you know, walk around and do what they want to do, because it's a little group of people. And I think we totally have to revamp the whole Lutheran thing if we really met children's needs. The Lutheran Church does not meet children's needs. We are not child-oriented. And for that reason, I really would say, you know, leave them in a nursery until they decide they want to come. This is what I told my kids. If you want to come to church with me, you can come, but you must understand that being in church involves sitting in a chair for a solid hour without saying anything. And, you know, they'd come once in a while, but they really didn't care for that, and they'd stay in the nursery. I know people think the nursery is just an abomination. Children should be in church, you know. You can take books for them to look at, or, you know, and give them things to draw, but a lot of people think that's just terrible. But I really feel the whole thing is above their needs. And, you know, at church maybe you can't get around that, but at home you can. And what I'm talking about is your home environment, which you can change to fit a child's developmental needs. Don't make rules that cut across their tasks, because what that says, they're not only hard for you to enforce, but what it says to the child is, I'm no good because I can't do this. Something inside of me is telling me, you know, do this, but mother is disapproving of that. And because of their tremendous need to belong, that says to them, I'm no good. You may have experienced that in childhood. I sure did. Not with my mother, but with my dad. There were things that I did that he disapproved of, but they were, you know, things that were part of being a human child at that age.
But if you're the minister's child, it's even worse.
And I was.
Yeah. So was I.
One thing, as a partial answer, is that some of our families in our church have been helped with that. You have the kids get up front, so there's more action up front than being back there, even though there's more risk, but at least something's happening.
And we're oriented more for the kids, I think, with children's sermons and participating in baptism and things like that.
Yeah, I was thinking of doing that. I like sitting in the back.
Yeah, because you usually do sit in the back so you can get out if it
really
gets too involved.
Yeah,
there's nothing to see back there.
Yeah. I have an 8-year-old who does not want to sit in church. He wants to move.
Mm-hmm.
He can't. He hates it.
And why can't there be something in the church? You know, why couldn't the 8-year-old go along and help pass out the offering plate? Or, you know, why couldn't they, instead of putting the pencils in those little things, let the 8-year-olds pass out the pencils just so they feel involved, so they feel part of it? You know, they...
Or maybe go around and entertain a smaller child who's bored.
Yes.
That would occupy their time.
There are doodle bulletins that you can get.
We just started that 2 weeks ago.
That's
the people there, they still don't understand.
Around
they
and
say
they hear you
children should be in church, but they, mm-hmm.
you know
maybe
I
some kids
do. Have a discussion about children in church with the whole congregation.
Oh, really? I mean, you know, I think we need to talk, if we really believe that they are part of the baptized membership of this group, then we need to change our efforts. I know my mother said something about reverence, because she felt there was a lack of reverence in our church because of these children talking and wandering around and so on. And I said, yeah, but Mother, how else can their needs be met? You know, it took me a while to learn to, you know, think, to worship through that distraction. But I felt like it was certainly easier for me as an adult to change than to ask this little kid to change. Okay, we need to, it's noon, we need to go, and we haven't gotten. Another thing I wanted to say, and do go to Ginny's session tomorrow, because she's going to talk about communicating. You can avoid a lot of need for disciplining if you learn how to feel negative feelings, because negative behavior is always preceded by a negative feeling. Now that is a real good thing to remember. If a child has a negative feeling, it can be dissipated before the negative behavior erupts. And I wish we could have another session tomorrow on how to handle feelings, but Ginny's going to talk about that some, so go to her session. If a child is angry, and he can talk about it, or he can paint a picture about it, or you will even listen to him. Help children to learn to talk about their feelings, but that means you've got to learn to listen. And she's going to talk, I think, about listening skills. That is really an awfully big help with raising children, to learn to recognize when the child, very often they'll tell you something and that isn't what the problem is at all. That's a cover-up for the problem. Oh, I got to recommend a book to you people, quick, before anybody, the bell rings or something. This is called Your Child Self-Esteem. I think